Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 230. Yes, it is. And we're going to, we're gonna break some rules. Yes, this is the week where I break the rules. We're going to talk about a little bit of religion and politics. We're also going to talk about electric cooking, why you should consider only cooking with electric in your van, depending on things. A product review of something that annoys many people, because, you know, you might want to buy one too. And then other stuff. And hey, guys, time out here. I'm making the T symbol with my hands. I don't know why, but this week I've decided I'm just going to break some rules. And the big rule I have for this podcast is that I don't discuss religion and politics, because when you discuss religion and politics, that's your entire show. Doesn't matter what your other topic is, you have suddenly become a religious or a political or a politically religious show, and that isn't what I want to do here. I want to talk about vans and travel and stuff like that, and I'm going to do that this week too. But I am going to cross the line a little bit in a couple of ways, especially towards the end of the podcast. If you are somebody who doesn't want to hear any sort of criticism of religion, and that tends to lead towards politics, then I recommend you skip to another week, go listen to another podcast, or leave before I get to the resource recommendation part. Because the resource recommendation part definitely discusses religion and politics. Okay? Now, I know, just say that some of you are like fast-forwarding to see, oh, what's he going to say? Because this isn't the most scandalous, gossipy podcast in the world, but and it still isn't. That's my warning for you, and if you decide to leave, thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next week. Now, we're going to start off with a Bible quote. Folks, I am not a religious person, and I will not be interpreting the Bible for you, but there is something I learned about the Bible a long time ago. It's one of these off-said phrases that can be interpreted 900 different ways, and for some reason, it tickled me today because it can be interpreted for van life, and this relates to a conversation we were having in the Discord channel. Anyway, let me just jump right in and see if I can make any sense of this. In the New Testament of the Bible, Matthew 19:23 through 24 is, "And again I say to you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God." A lot of people have discussed what eye of a needle means. Some people say it was literal, you know, like the eye of a needle for sewing. How can a man ever fit through that small hole? Other people have said the eye of the needle was actually the entrance to the marketplace, and an overloaded camel would have a really hard time fitting through there, so it was an apt analogy for the people of the time. And I don't care about any of that. I'm taking the analogy in a way different direction, because in my telling of this, the kingdom of God is a successful van life. And no, I'm not saying they're comparable. This is an analogy, it's a metaphor. So cut me some slack there. One clear interpretation of this passage is that if you're rich, it's hard for you to do things that aren't so hard for people who aren't so rich. And I think that's true for van life too. Last week, we talked about a piece that the Curious Toad wrote about how the spirit of van life was minimalism, which is a very commonly held belief, and something I actually agree with to some extent, and that led one thing to another and a whole bunch of rabbit holes, and it made me realize that if you are coming to van life with very little, you're probably going to have a more successful van life. Yes, you get to decide success the way you want. For me, van life is a success if you enjoy it. That's a pretty low bar there. I'm going to tell you a story, though, about what informed me of this opinion. An old friend contacted me on Facebook, hadn't talked to her for years, and she said, "Hey, I'm thinking about doing some van life." And I was like, "Oh, great, all right, what do you need?" And so she doesn't know anything about vehicles or RVs or campers or anything, so she kept sending me, "What about this one? What about this one?" She was basically combing Facebook Marketplace for all these different vans. And I would say, "Oh, that's a 1973 Dodge van with the high top. They were very classic campers at the time. They're great vehicles. They're very comfortable inside, easy to park, and it's hard to find parts." You know, I had this whole list for everything she showed me. And as we got on here, I started talking about, you know, well, this vehicle is very big. It's going to be hard to keep cool. And she's like, oh, well, what do you mean it's hard to keep cool? And I, you know, explained, well, you know, when you have a vehicle this big, it takes a lot of power to run an air conditioner, if you even have one. And then it all fell apart because she said, well, what do you mean? Why wouldn't I have air conditioning? And so I talked about how air conditioning is the hardest problem to solve in van life and how it requires so much power that unless you're plugged in, it's very difficult or at least very expensive. And it blew her mind. She had seen all these Instagram posts of van life and how cool it looked, and she loved the old retro vehicles and everything. But she had actually never been in an RV, never spent any time camping at all. And the idea that she couldn't keep the temperature in the van within 1 degree of where she wanted it had never occurred to her, and it was a deal breaker. So I took everything back and I said, well, how much do you like camping? And she says, oh, I hate camping. The idea of like sleeping in a tent in the dirt, ooh, I would never want to do that. And I was like, oh, okay, because that has always been my big red flag there. Is that if you enjoy camping, you're going to enjoy van life. And if you despise camping, if you think camping is just horrible and nothing you'd ever want to do, you're probably not going to like van life. And that's the weak analogy here of rich versus poor. I'm not actually talking about money. I'm talking about folks who have always lived in an environment that was tailored to them are going to have a much harder time doing van life. So if you're listening to this podcast and you're doing so because you want to look into this van life thing and see if it's for you, let me reiterate. Van life is not comfortable. That's not really true. You can make van life comfortable, but your ability to make it comfortable is directly related to your ability to be flexible. When I'm at home in my condo, I like the temperature to be between, well, it depends on the day. I don't know, between, say, 73 and 76, somewhere around there, Fahrenheit, you know, maybe 22, 24 degrees Celsius, somewhere around there. That's what I like. If I have a choice between hotter and colder, I want it colder. That's just me. Other people are different. I get it. It's fine. But when I go out in my van, I mentally adjust that those standards no longer apply. Now, I'm going to be comfortable between 50 and 90 degrees Fahrenheit. And then at night for sleeping, I'll be comfortable 40 to 80. Those are the temperature ranges that I've set for myself, and those are what I know I can tolerate. They're not as comfortable as sleeping in a house. But because I can adjust, I can do van life successfully. In fact, one of the things I do is before I get to where I'm staying for the night, and I do this all the time when I'm heading down to Tiki Bago Land, my little river property there on the Illinois River in Illinois, I turn off the AC, turn off everything, and I roll down all the windows in whatever vehicle I'm driving as I roll into the site to remind myself that, yep, you're giving up this. It's time to get used to it. And that, you know, 5 minutes of just realizing, oh, it's actually humid and the temperature's a little warmer than I like, that's enough to let me adjust to what I'm about to be doing. This principle that having a lot of things makes it difficult to do other things, I think is a good thing to remember for a lot of things. Because I feel very wealthy when I look at my van that I built out, for example. I have this old 2011 diesel Sprinter that I'm completely comfortable in, with quotation marks. It's what I want. It does what I want. I love it. And not everybody could. I think if you are used to having everything tailored to you in every possible way, you're going to be very frustrated very quickly with van life. Especially if you're somebody who has a lot of money and buys one of those $225,000 vans and hits the road and then realizes that, oh, I have to hook up the hoses to the black tank? I thought they just did that for you. All right, lots of caveats and disclaimers here. I understand that not every wealthy person is afraid of dealing with their own black waste. I get that. A lot of wealthy people like to hike and sleep in the dirt. And, you know, you understand what I'm saying here. But the principle, I think, holds true. how successful you are in van life is directly related to how flexible you can be, and how flexible you can be is directly related to how flexible you've had to be in your whole life. And being flexible comes from not being catered to. That's it. That's my whole point. If you disagree with me, please, please write me and let me know. I'm anxious to have more conversations on these things because that's how I learn stuff. And I like to learn stuff. So I am Jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And I'll be happy to have a conversation with you. Or you can jump on the Discord channel and tell me how wrong I am. That is BuiltToGo, a Discord server or channel. It doesn't matter. All the links are at BuiltToGo.com. Special thank you to Lewis for the diesel. Thank you, Lewis. Lewis has written me a couple of very insightful emails, which I have been terrible at replying to, and I apologize for that. But Lewis is one of those who has bought me a gallon of diesel at buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. And because of Lewis and all the other folks like him, especially the folks who donate every month, there are no ads on this podcast, but I have an asterisk on that. The resource recommendation could very well be considered an ad. It's just an ad that I'm choosing. I'm not getting paid from that ad. Nobody contacted me and said, run this ad. But I'm running it anyway. So, that caveat there. Thank you guys very much. Tech Talk. So, one of the things Lewis wrote me about was electric cooking. He drives his van all over Europe and cooks electrically. And he wrote me way back in January of 2023, that long ago, about this great post about all the electric cooking he's done. And I read the email. It influenced a lot of my podcast content after that, but for some reason I didn't respond. And I apologize for that, Lewis. But now I'm going to respond because in the time since he wrote that and my new experiences, I think electric cooking is more of an option now than ever. And I know I've said that before, but I wanted to go into it in some detail for this week's Tech Talk. Lewis has a fairly simple setup. I mean, it's not super simple, but he's got a 300 amp hour lithium iron phosphate battery, which are much more affordable now than they used to be. He's got 560 watts of solar, which is a lot of solar, but he's in the UK where they don't have that much sun. So if you live up north, you have to get more solar just to get the little bit of solar that everybody else can get down at the equator. You know what I'm saying there? Yes. And I imagine that takes up a lot of his roof space. And he's got a battery-to-battery charger and a 1600 watt inverter. And with that, he doesn't need to cook with propane or butane or any of the gases or alcohol or anything. He's able to cook for his needs just with his battery. And one of the secrets is that he's using an air fryer. And I am a big fan of air fryers now. I talked about this a couple weeks ago. Very simple air fryer I have works great. And it's better than microwaves in that it crisps things. I mean, that's the difference. You know, if you reheat pizza in the microwave, it gets soggy. If you reheat pizza in the air fryer, it stays crispy. That's the big thing. And for me, the ideal is having both an air fryer and a microwave. And yeah, it uses a lot of power, but it doesn't use it for that long. So he says that when he uses his air fryer on the 1600 watt inverter, it uses about 15 amp hours of battery capacity, which isn't that big of a deal. He can recover that very, very quickly. And here are some other reasons why you might want to consider electric cooking. It's easy to replace and repair if you're on the road. If something goes wrong with your propane system, it can be difficult to find parts. If you're using butane cooking, which I recommend, that's for a whole other thing. It's very hard to find those butane cans on the road. It's the ones that look like aerosol cans. Those are the ones I like, the gas one portable cookers. I hope you know what I'm talking about. But those cans are really hard to find on the road. And if you do find them, they're really expensive. The secret there is to go to an Asian supermarket. They have them. Or buy them from Amazon. But you don't have to worry about any of that if you do electric cooking. You can just use stuff you get at Walmart, and if it breaks, you can just go get another one at Walmart. And you have precise control over the temperature and how much power you're using. It won't use any power at all if you turn it off. You don't have to worry about the potential of a propane leak, which is a big deal for a lot of people. And it's generally easy to clean up. I mean, what you do to your pan, you're going to do to your pan, but getting stuff spilled in a gas burner is a big pain. With electric, you either have just a flat glass thing that you're cleaning, or the microwave, you know, and the air fryer, I find that the coating of the inside of the air fryer is really easy to clean up with just a wet paper towel. It also will produce less heat in your van. If you're cooking in the summer with electric heat, you're generally going to have less ambient heat, wasted heat coming off of it, than you would with a gas stove. And you don't have to worry about oxygen, because you're not using any oxygen, and you're also not releasing any gases into the van. There are a lot of things to recommend electric cooking. So if you're the kind of person who either has roof space for a whole lot of solar, or you're driving the van every day or almost every day, electric cooking might be all you need. And for most of the time, for me, it is. I'm light each night. My battery-to-battery charger pumps my batteries back up in a matter of hours, and I'm good to go again. Electric cooking is a good solution for me. It won't be a good solution for you if you're doing a lot of winter camping or you're very far north and you're not driving the van very often. If you're the kind of person who goes and parks the van for 2 weeks without a lot of solar, electric's going to be a little bit more difficult. Well, it's actually going to be a lot more difficult, so consider that. But anyway, Lewis, thank you for bringing this to my attention. I do think that 10 years from now, everybody's going to have almost fully electric vans, if not fully electric driving vans. We'll see how that goes. The cost of batteries and solar keeps dropping, so electric cooking is definitely much, much more feasible than it used to be. Product review. I can't believe I didn't know about this, but a friend of mine by the name of Yogi pointed out that she got these for her no-build SUV that she's doing, and I was like, that's such a great idea. So I went out and bought some, and I've been using them. In fact, I took them on the most recent trip I had to Bermuda, and it was great. And the irony of this thing is that this is something that I've seen more people write about getting rid of than adding to their van. And what this thing is an LED light. Now, hold on a sec. You're like, what the heck's he talking about? We talk about LED lights all the time. No. This is something different. This is a little tiny USB plug that you plug into any USB-A port, that's the rectangular one, and it makes a red light. That's it. That's all it does. There's no on-off switch, there's no brightness, you can't change the colors. It's just a little red LED light that plugs into a USB port and gives off some red light. And mostly I hear about when people are trying to sleep in their vans at night, all their gadgets are giving off too much light, and how do you cover them up? And there are ways to do that. They actually sell little stickers that you put over those lights. But this is exactly the opposite. And so they're so small that I've added them to my travel kit. And now wherever I go, if I want to have a little nightlight anywhere at all, I do. And I put one in the wall of the cabin on the most recent cruise I took, and it gave off just enough light so that we could make our way to the restroom without tripping on anything. You know what? These things are great. They're cheap, too. You get a bunch of them for $5, and you can just plug them in or take them out wherever you want. Another good place for these is, because the ones I'm recommending are red, they do come in other colors, but I recommend the red ones, is in your vehicle, whether it's a van or a truck or whatever, you probably have USB ports in the dashboard. And if you have an old truck, those USB ports probably don't give off all that much power. But these lights will fit right in there, and they give you the ability to see more in your vehicle at night without having to turn on the lights and without messing up your night vision. So, for example, if you have cup holders down low, you can plug in one of these little red lights down there, and you can see enough to find your cup in the dark. Not everybody's going to want or need these things, but I think for $5, or I think they're $5.30 for four right now, they're a neat little thing, and they're one of these things that if you carry them around, you're going to find a use for them. One great use that I just thought of is you can use them to check to see if an outlet works. Is this thing powered when the van's on? Yes, no. Does that USB port at the airport actually work? Plug this in, you'll know for sure. And one of these things that if you carry them around, you're going to find a use for them. So, heck, thanks, Yogi. I'm going to add them to my kit from now on, and I'm very glad to have found them. And I'm especially going to use them when I do the Star Stair stuff at Rocky Mountain Star Stair, which is a dark sky sight. No white lights are allowed after dark. And if I just put a couple of these in my van, that's going to be all the light I need to get in and out and get situated. So thank you. I think they're great. Link in the show notes. Tales from the Road. So we're going to talk about Salem, Massachusetts in the next segment, but I'm going to tell you a story from Salem about a friend of mine who did something kind of scary. I may have told the story before, and like I said, I reserve the right to continually tell stories the more I age, because that's the way it's going, whether I want it to or not. But back in the day, we were kids growing up in Salem, Mass, you know, get all those Stand By Me vibes there. You know, it was kind of like, no, it wasn't anything like that, really. It wasn't as idealistic as that, but it was similar in that we would take these incredibly long bike trips, and I don't know that our parents ever knew where we were. You know, this is the big Gen X meme about how our parents neglected us. I would literally leave the house at 9 a.m. on my bike and then disappear until 6. My parents would have no idea where I was. Now, I grew up in, again, I tell you, this is the truth, Witchcraft Heights. The part of Salem I grew up in was called Witchcraft Heights because it's the heights of Salem. It was thought that this is where the victims of the witch trial were hanged on Gallows Hill, which was the middle of Witchcraft Heights. That's where the big water tower is. If you've ever been to Salem, there's a giant green water tower with a witch on the side of it. That's Gallows Hill. We now know that that isn't where the witches were hanged. Doesn't matter. Moving along. There is a place in Salem called Winter Island, and it is now a campground. In fact, if you are going to go to Salem, see next segment, and you're in your van, I recommend you stay at Winter Island if you can. But Winter Island, as the name suggests, was an island, and it was a winter island because it was in the winter harbor of Salem. Salem came to prominence because of the excellent harbor it has. There was a summer harbor and the winter harbor, and the winter harbor was where you could safely have ships in the winter where they wouldn't get stuck in ice. This island was in that harbor. The island has had forts on it since before the Revolution. Fort Pickering is still there. It's been built up, and it has been in use up until World War II, when the entire island was turned into a PBY base. A PBY is a seaplane. It's a big military seaplane, and the planes would land in the harbor and be dragged up onto Winter Island, and so on. It was abandoned pretty much completely in the 50s, and throughout the 60s and 70s, the island was just nothing. Now, I should add that at some point, the island was attached to land, so you could actually drive there. That was probably in the early 1900s. But for most of my childhood growing up in Salem, this was no man's land. It was abandoned. There was a school on the road to the island called the Plummer Home for Boys. It was always mysterious to us. We didn't really know, like, what went on there. You know, we didn't know anyone who went there. We went to the public schools. Who goes to the Plummer Home for Boys? I mean, do they live there? It looks like a school. And I found out what it was for later, but we're not going to get into that. Just know that there was this mysterious building filled with mysterious boys. One day, I had the bright idea of exploring Winter Island, and I got a bunch of the neighborhood kids together, and we all took our bicycles and rode from Witchcraft Heights all the way down to Winter Island, which was a few miles. It was a serious ride, and we went through the gates of the gatehouse, because this was a military base. It was all abandoned. Walked through there, and we were clearly someplace we were not supposed to be. Everything was overgrown and broken glass and abandoned buildings. There was one building that had been burned out many times because the Salem firefighters had used it for fire practice. You know, all the walls were ripped out because somebody had stolen all the copper. It was that kind of a place. This was urban exploration. Although, the 1976 version. And so, you know, we're riding around looking at stuff, and there are these big creepy kind of catacombs built into the fort, and we were a little too scared to go down there. We walked around the beach, which I found out later is called Waikiki Beach, because the people stationed there in World War II thought it looked like Hawaii. Doesn't. And then finally we got to the hangar, which is this massive airplane hangar. It's where they used to park the PBYs, and the doors were missing. The big, huge doors, they were gone, so we were able to walk right in. And it was filled mostly with trash, but in the corner, there was an elevator shaft. And for some reason, we climbed up the elevator shaft and went onto the roof of the hangar. I don't know why we did this. We're not very smart, and as I was the oldest kid in the group, that's entirely my fault. But we're standing on the roof of the hangar. If you imagine this hangar, it's two rectangular buildings with a domed building in the middle. We were on the roof of one of the side rectangular buildings, so not on the domed part, which was good because we could kind of see through it. There were so many holes in it. And we're on the rectangular part, and one of my friends decides he wants to go higher, and he actually climbs up onto the counterweight of the elevator inside the shaft above the roof. And it's all greasy, and we're just like, what are you doing? Where are you going? And I don't know what his motivation was. But I do know that at that point, the rest of us decided we've had enough of this, and we climbed back down. There was actually a ladder in the elevator shaft. That wasn't hard. And went back out on the tarmac, and he didn't follow us. Like, yo, what are you doing? Come on, we gotta go. It turned out that, like a cat up a tree, he had climbed up so far he was too afraid to come down. And this put us in a situation because we were completely isolated from the rest of civilization. You really couldn't get to us because the road was blocked. If the police or fire department wanted to actually get to us, they would have to move massive barriers. And we didn't have cell phones. This was 1976, so, you know, one of us would have to walk all the way until we found a payphone, which was probably over a mile or 2 miles, just to get help. And then, holy cow, we were going to be in huge, massive trouble. So we're trying to talk him down. We didn't know how to, like, help him get down. It's not like we had belaying equipment or anything. He wasn't going to rappel down the shaft. We're just trying to use psychology to get him to come down. We all made it down. We knew it was safe. He was able to climb up. There was certainly a way for him to get down. And we were like, you know, put your foot here and put your hand here and all this stuff. And he just wouldn't come down. And so finally, the way we solved this problem is we left him there. Yeah, that's how we solved it. We left. We said, well, if you're just going to stay there, we're just going to go. And off we walked to go get our bicycles that we had parked some distance away. Now, I wasn't really going to leave him there, obviously. I knew that this was probably going to make him come down, because as we left, this old creaky hangar was going to get more and more creepy, and his motivation to join us would be a little bit greater. Now, side note, as an adult telling the story, I'm absolutely horrified at all of this, and the danger involved is just terrible. But it is, in fact, what happened. And fortunately, he did climb down safely and join us. He had grease all over him. I don't know how he was going to explain that to his parents. When we got to our bikes, there were other kids there. Some of the kids from the plumber home for boys had actually found our bikes and were trying to figure out what was going on. Now, it was very clear that these kids, who were older than us and bigger than us, thought of this whole abandoned island as their turf. And while I'm certain there were rules in the home that they weren't allowed to go past the barriers or something like that, they didn't seem to care too much. And we had a situation where it looked like this could get ugly. Now, I, being the older one, was the one talking to them, and they're like, hey, what are you kids doing here? And I'm like, oh, you know, we're just exploring. It's cool. And then the greasy kid who came down the elevator shaft comes up and says, we gotta go. We gotta go. And there was something about the sight of him that actually scared these kids. I don't really understand what it was. But his look and his insistence that we needed to go and these kids that were about to menace us, it was of no concern to him. And just that fact seemed to break the spell. So, taking this opportunity, we got on our bikes and rode away as fast as we could. These kids didn't have bikes, but they were not shy about shouting, you know, don't come back, this is our place, blah, blah, blah. And, well, we heeded that. Until a couple years later, when the island was cleaned up and fixed up a bit and turned into kind of a park, and then over time that became a campground. And now it's actually a very, very popular campsite. And it's an interesting place to camp because you can camp in the hills that used to be the fort that was Fort Pickering going way back to the War of 1812, or you can camp over by the hangar on pavement overlooking the water. Anyway, it's a pretty cool spot. I'm glad to have these memories. But holy cow, there are times I look back and it's a wonder that I ever survived childhood, not to mention my friends. A place to visit. You may have noticed that I skipped the news section this week, and that's part of my breaking rules, but I really wanted to talk about Salem, Massachusetts as a place to visit. If you've listened to this podcast for any time, you know that I grew up in Salem, Massachusetts. Heck, I just told you that. But Salem, Massachusetts, where I grew up, doesn't exist anymore. And they say you can never go home. I get that. I talk a lot about how when you travel, you're not only traveling to places, you're traveling to times, and you can go back to the place, but you can't go back to the time. I understand all that. And I left Salem in the late 80s, and I can never go back, not only because of the general principle, but because Salem has changed so very much. And I wanted to talk about that for a bit. If you want to visit Salem, Massachusetts, it's either for one of two reasons. The first reason is you are very interested in history and interesting things. Salem excels at history and interesting. The second is that you're a big fan of spooky season. Well, folks, when I was a kid, there was no spooky season. Salem started this event called Haunted Happenings on Salem Common, which is this big grassy area in the middle of the city, right next to the quote-unquote Witch Museum. And it was just little thing where in October people would go and do costumes, and there were some market stalls and stuff, and it was fun. But that has taken over the entire city. The entire downtown of Salem now, which is a city of 50, 60,000 people, is completely dedicated to spooky season. And we've gone well beyond witches here. It's vampire shops and oral readings and it's like Sedona. If you've ever been to Sedona, Arizona, Salem is like that, only more spooky. And it wasn't like that. What has happened, in my estimation, is that Salem, because of the success of films like Hocus Pocus and Bewitched, the film, not the series, has become Spooky Town Central, and people go there to live Halloween all the time. Now, I was there on a Thursday in September, and I thought that was safe. I thought it was safe to go there because, you know, Halloween is 6 weeks away or 5 weeks away. Yeah, no. Thursday afternoon, we couldn't find parking in downtown Salem. And the signs said that parking on weekends anywhere in the city of Salem downtown area is $40. Now, by Chicago standards, that's not terrible. But by the North Shore of Massachusetts standards, that is outrageous. And that's why I wanted to talk about visiting Salem. If you are a history person, and if you are a history person, Salem is extremely rich in history. First public phone call, first millionaire, first elephant in the United States. I mean, there's a lot to see history-wise there. Salem was supposed to be the capital of Massachusetts when Roger Conant came over in 1626, but Governor Winthrop's son drowned in the North River of Salem, so he said, screw this place, and he went to Charlestown, which later he moved down to Boston. Anyway, that's a long history thing, but there's a ton of history there. That's the stuff I love, and that includes the witch trials, but that's really buried beneath the surface now. You have to go deep to find that stuff. Sure, if you take a trolley tour or whatever, they will mention it. But when you visit Salem now, what you're going to see is witch shop after costume shop after fart shop, tourist, none of it having to do with Salem, and lots of people walking around wearing witch hats, just like you would see Mickey Mouse ears at Disney. That's what you're going to see. And I know that's what a lot of you want to see. And that's fine. Being someone who grew up in Salem, am a little bit sad that the old Salem isn't there anymore. I mean, it is still there. It's beneath the surface. Someone described Salem as an incredible place buried under a veneer of crap. And you have to dig through the crap to get to the incredible stuff. I don't think that's unfair. However, if you're going to visit Salem, I'm going to give you some tips. First off, if you want to see spooky season, go in September rather than October. In October, the city becomes completely overwhelmed. You'll be glad to pay that $40 for parking because there isn't any. You're not going to find it. Everything is full. There's only two hotels in town. They're already booked. Don't even bother. You're years out for getting those. Salem, the city, isn't on an interstate. You have to drive through fairly small local roads to get there, but there is a train. If you can, take the commuter line, which will drop you off right near where all the Salem spooky stuff begins. That is an excellent option. That train stops in Beverly, Lynn, and all the stops in between from Boston to Salem. Beverly's actually north of there. Anyway, look at the route. It used to be called the B&M. It's the purple line on the MTA. You'll find it. That is probably your best bet for getting in and out of Salem. If you can, bicycling in Salem is an excellent option. You can walk around the town, but if you want to get out to Winter Island and Salem Willows and places like that, you're going to be very glad to have a bicycle. There are trolleys that go around town. Those are fine. A lot of the tour guides that you talk to in Salem will be entertainers. They're going to be enhancing spooky season. They're not going to be worried so much about the authenticity of the history. For example, one of the things in Salem is called the Witch House, and it's mostly artificial. The house has some timbers from an original house there, but if you look at pictures of the house from, say, 1910, it's actually a drugstore with a square building. So that is often hidden. In fact, I had a conversation with a tour guide recently, and they didn't even know that. In the Witch Museum, the most popular place to visit in Salem, and it's been there since the 50s, the Witch Museum is an old Unitarian church that has a shadow box display built into it. So when you walk in there, what you're actually going to see is a glowing red pentangle on the floor, which is kind of cool, but yet completely misses the point. You're going to see basically these light up shadow boxes that tell the story of the witch trials. And it's not terrible. They don't get things wrong. That will actually tell you the story. But it's not a museum. It's a show. And of course, you exit through the gift shop, and it's a huge gift shop. And if you've played Fallout 4, well, there might be a Deathclaw in the basement, so don't go down there. So know what you're getting into. You could wait in line for hours to see that. It's just a 1950s shadow box. I kind of like it. It's nostalgic for me, but it's not a museum. Now, one of the things that really bothers me here is that people have turned an absolute tragedy into fun. I don't wish to offend anybody, and this is too much comparison, but imagine if you visited Auschwitz and they had turned it into an amusement park. Because that's how it feels to me. No, it's not that degree, but it's similar in its taking a preventable tragedy and turning it into fun. And that bothers me. The entire time you're in Salem, I ask that you remember that there were no witches in Salem. There were a number of victims of societal fears and pressures and greed, and there's a whole bunch of things that went into this. And these people were killed by their government for basically things they absolutely weren't guilty of, including Giles Corey, who was never convicted of witchcraft. He was pressed to death because he wouldn't plea guilty or not. Because if he pleaded, or pled, whichever you prefer, that he was guilty or not, his wife would have lost claim to their property. So he let them crush him to death rather than actually giving in to them. It's horrible stuff. And I have a hard time relating that horrible stuff to the people walking around with their witch hats. So if you want to go to Salem and learn about the history of Salem, please do that. There are a number of memorials around town. There are a lot of things to see. Danvers, Massachusetts, is Salem Village. That's where a lot of these people lived. And the Rebecca Nurse Home there is the place to go if you really want to learn some of the history. But I have to recommend the Peabody Essex Museum. Doesn't matter why you're going to Salem, you're going to want to go there. This is a world-class museum. It outclasses Salem. It's a better museum than Salem should have. But it started off as a cabinet of curiosities that the sea captains used to bring all their weird stuff back and put here so people could see it. It's called Marine Hall in East India Square. And then over the years, it has grown into what it is now, which is not that. It is now a fine arts and history museum that has amazing exhibits. In fact, one of the exhibits right now is on spiritualism, which is one of the reasons I visited recently, because James the Amazing Randy's husband had a piece in that exhibit. And yes, Randy was there too, and I wanted to see that, which is a great exhibit. You should absolutely go see that if you're going to go soon. But there's another exhibit in there on the witch hysteria. Or, I'm sorry, I don't like using that term. The witch trials. And it has actual artifacts from 1692. And you can learn what actually happened. Please, if you go to Salem, have fun. But also remember why you're going to Salem. It's not like Hocus Pocus. It's like people being abused and murdered by the state for greed and fear. That's what it's actually like. And that's actually something that's still going on today. And I don't like to see it celebrated. That bewitched statue of Nicole Kidman really irks me. I just don't like it. Anyway, if any of you are going to Salem and you'd like to ask me questions, I took a course on historic Salem. I know a lot of stuff that the tour guides won't tell you. If you're interested in hearing me ramble about it, send me a note at jeff@builtogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. I could do a whole podcast of what it was like growing up in Salem, and that's as much as I'm going to do here. Okay, resource recommendation. This is the controversial part. This is the part where you should leave, especially if you are a member or are fond of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Still here? Okay, here we go. I have a friend. It's hard to believe, but I do. I have a friend. His name is Steve Kuno. Steve Kuno, I've known for quite a while now. He came to me through the James Randi Educational Foundation. He was a conference attendee and then later a conference speaker. He is an accomplished writer and has had a very successful career in marketing for his whole life. And you may have picked up that I'm not a big fan of marketing, but I am a big fan of Steve because he is an ethical marketer. He has this line where lies are bad. He doesn't like lies, and that's the important line to me. Anyway, Steve is an author. He's written a few books, and I am halfway through his most recent book, which just came out on audio. The name of the book is Behind the Mormon Curtain, Selling Sex in America's Holy City. This is a nonfiction expose, if you will, of the sex trade in Salt Lake City and the rest of Utah. And Steve basically took the time to interview a whole bunch of people working in this trade in a city that prides itself on basically not having any of this stuff. But it does. And as you may have guessed, the clientele of many of these women are the same people who will espouse moral values from the highest places in the church. Now, I'm not a religious person. My morals and ethics do not come from a church. And I have no problem with sex work. I just don't. This, to me, is trading your time and labor for somebody else's money. And to me, that's not a lot different than digging a ditch or driving a taxi or programming a website. Sure, there's different risks, there's different dynamics, I understand that, but the morality of paying someone for sex doesn't bother me at all, as long as nobody's lying or cheating or treating anyone badly. Two or more consenting adults, totally fine with it. That's my personal thing. And Steve's book goes into quite some depth about what life is like for these women and how this can go on in a city that doesn't have things like this. It's a fascinating read, and better yet, the audiobook is read in Steve's voice because, well, Steve read it. That's how they do that trick there. Steve is an excellent narrator, and I love it when the authors actually read the books because they know how to inflect things. You know, a sentence on the page is dead until somebody adds inflections, and Steve adds the right inflections because they're his. Now, this is a very honest book. It's a very frank book. There are times when you might find it titillating. There are times when you might be absolutely disgusted by what's in here. It covers the gamut. It is the definitive work on sex work in Utah. And it goes into the history. If you're unfamiliar with the church, it tells the history of the church. And I have to say, even though I'm not a member of the church, and I did live in Utah, and I have certain feelings about how the government and the religion are combined there, Steve gives a very frank telling of how the Mormon church came to be. I don't think anyone would have any problem with that. And another part that isn't obvious from the title. This book humanizes sex workers. They are not what you think they are unless you know them personally. They're people. They do things that people do. Yes, they quote-unquote sell their bodies for money, as most of us do in one way or another. But they also pay bills and deal with leaky trash cans in the kitchen and fight with their landlords, etc., etc., etc. But they have to do a lot of these things below the radar. And at the same time, advertise their services. It's a very interesting dynamic, and how it's done is thoroughly explained in the book. Anyway, I don't want to spoil anything. You can read his description at Amazon.com. Of course, I've got the link in the show notes. It's available on Kindle, it's available hardcover, and it's available on audio. I am recommending this not because Steve asked me to, but because it's good. That is why I'm adding this, and I find it an incredibly good companion for those long hours on the road. The audiobook is just shy of 8 hours long, and believe it or not, I make a brief appearance. You'll have to get the book to see exactly what role I play. I find it totally engaging. It makes the hours melt away, and I'm only halfway through because I haven't done a lot of driving lately, but I'm actually looking forward to driving again so I can finish the book. Anyway, the name of the book is Behind the Mormon Curtain, Selling Sex in America's Holy City, and the author is Steve Kuno, a longtime resident of Utah, and a man who knows what he's talking about. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 230 of Built to Go. This has been an unusual episode in a series of unusual episodes, and thank you for putting up with my breaking of the rules today. But you have to do it every once in a while. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. Until next time, remember the words of Douglas MacArthur, who said, "You are remembered for the rules you break." I'm not sure that's a good thing.